I'm going to analyze and sum up some of the major points of this very important article. By the way, there are some connections of the Free Congress Foundation to other Eastern European countries, which I will be talking about in a future installment of this archive series, probably next week. After having looked at, in the first two installments, the external pressure being applied on the Soviet Union, that's part of the binary paradigm put forward by Sean Gervaisi vis-a-vis destabilization, we did look at internal interference in Lithuania in our first installment. That is part of what I see as, in essence, a flanking maneuver, both on the Soviet southern flank with the Gulf War and on the northern flank with an attempt to destabilize and split away from the USSR, the Baltic republics, a key strategic area for the USSR. Now, this evening, with this article, we're taking a look at internal manipulation of Soviet politics. One of the main vehicles for this is the Free Congress Foundation, founded by Paul Weyrich, one of the individuals credited with the political organization that helped boost Ronald Reagan and George Bush to power, also an individual who founded the Heritage Foundation, a key right-wing think tank with very strong links to the Bush and Reagan administrations. One of the key people on the FCF board is George Moser, a George Washington University professor, who is on the editorial advisory board of the Ukrainian Quarterly and closely linked with elements grouped around the OUN. That is a Ukrainian nationalist and fascist organization that we've looked at in past archive shows. And it's quite obvious that the Free Congress Foundation is not a democratically inclined organization, at least not from the information we see here. NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, has been working with the FCF, and the key element for us to remember here is that the Free Congress Foundation is very close to Boris Yeltsin, and we should bear in mind that the Free Congress Foundation is a direct outgrowth of the American far right, and so we now see Boris Yeltsin and his organization directly connected to the American far right. And it should be noted also, in addition to the successes that the Free Congress Foundation has enjoyed in the USSR, that an individual that they have boosted into to head their Liberation Support Alliance is a fellow named Laszlo Pastor, who, as I said earlier, is a Hungarian fascist, an individual connected to the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, and an individual that we looked at, and again, just like Paul Weyrich, he's not only connected with politics in the Eastern Europe, but he's also very closely connected with politics in the United States, as we looked at in that miscellaneous archive show. And it should be noted, too, that Laszlo Pastor is connected with the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. One of the key elements of that is the OUN, as we looked at in this particular article. We've looked at the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations in Radio Free America shows 14 and 15, as well as the miscellaneous archive show that I alluded to, Nazis and Anti-Semites on the George Bush campaign. And we also took a look at the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations in The Guns of November Part 4. When Lee Harvey Oswald returned to the United States, he was met not by the FBI or CIA, but by Spaz Rakin of the Friends of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. We came back to those connections in a big way in Radio Free America 15. It should be noted that the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, as indicated here, was founded in alliance with Adolf Hitler in 1943. The ABN, an element very close to the Reagan and Bush administrations, represents a direct link between the fascism of contemporary America and what appears to be going on in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and the fascism of World War II. It is, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. We will be coming back to the ABN and Laszlo Pastor in weeks to come in this particular archive series. Again, I have theorized that the United States is attempting to provoke a new Cold War in order to further destabilize the Soviet Union, or else it is going to attempt to split the Soviet Union up into its constituent republics, which would then be exploited by Western multinational corporations. I think that the hard line crackdown, the return to a Cold War, is the most probable scenario. I can't say for sure. I've made mistakes in the past, but I cannot somehow see the Soviet National Security Establishment sitting by and tolerating the dismemberment of the Soviet Union. They have already stated, that is to say, the Soviet military and KGB, have stated publicly that they will not stand for that. Now, in the first installment of this archive show, I spoke about Mikhail Gorbachev's unsuccessful peace initiative vis-a-vis the Gulf War as an attempt to stave off this, in essence, American flanking maneuver on the Soviet southern flank. I read a short section of an article from the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday, February 20th of 1991. I will reread that section of the article. This is an article headline, Soviet Peace Proposal Falls Short, Bush Says. And it's subheaded, Diplomacy. President is critical of the plan, but officials say it has not been rejected. Iraq's response to initiative calling for pullout is expected today. It's by James Gerstenzang, Gerstenzang, G-E-R-S-T-E-N-Z-A-N-G, of the L.A. Times, Dateline Washington. It reads in part as follows. President Bush on Tuesday threw cold water on the new Soviet peace plan, saying, quote, it falls well short of what would be required, unquote, to end the Gulf War. Skipping down, although details of the plan remain secret, the Soviets have described it as, quote, fully in line, unquote, with the United Nations demands for an unconditional Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. But the plan also reportedly offered assurances of no penalties for Iraq or its leadership, along with other controversial points. This came out the day after. This particular edition is the day after this proposal was put forward. It should be noted that the day after Gorbachev put this peace initiative forward, we find the following. Gorbachev must go, Yeltsin says. It's by John Thor Dahlberg, D-A-H-L-B-U-R-G, of the L.A. Times. It's headlined, Dateline Moscow, and it reads in part, exploding a political bombshell on live nationwide television, Boris N. Yeltsin issued an unprecedented call Tuesday night for Soviet President Mikhail S. Gorbachev's immediate resignation, charging that Gorbachev's reform drive has degenerated into a quest for boundless dictatorial powers. It is interesting that we find, as we've seen in that excellent article by Ballant and Wolf, that Boris Yeltsin and the IRG are very closely connected with the Free Congress Foundation, a direct outgrowth of the American far right, with explicit fascist elements included in it. And it is interesting to see Yeltsin issue this blistering attack the day after Gorbachev issued the peace proposal, and my analysis, also incidentally that of the William Randolph Hearst Jr. of the San Francisco Examiner, an individual with whom I have very little in common, he also saw the Gorbachev peace initiative as an attempt to protect his southern flank. It's interesting that we see Yeltsin, himself obviously directly connected to the forces of reaction in this country, attacking Gorbachev. I suspect, I cannot prove obviously, but I suspect that those two things are directly connected. It should be borne in mind, too, that the Free Congress Foundation has been heavily involved in teaching techniques of political organization to the organizations that it has taken under its wing. Reading again from this Covert Action Information Bulletin article. By the way, this is, once again, Covert Action Information Bulletin, issue number 35, from the fall of 1990. The address, Covert Action Information Bulletin, P.O. Box 34583, P.O. Box 34583, that's in Washington, D.C., 20043. Once again, Covert Action Information Bulletin, P.O. Box 34583, Washington, D.C., 20043. And going back again to a short section of the Free Congress Foundation article by Ballant and Wolf, in one of the training sessions by FCF in Moscow in November of 1989, the participants were trained, quote, in the political techniques of recruitment of volunteers, organization of volunteers, identification and turnout of volunteers, election day activities, the building of coalitions, and methods of communicating with the voters. And it's worth assessing that as we watch Yeltsin and his machinations, and in particular as we see these huge demonstrations against Gorbachev taking place in the Soviet Union. It should be noted that Secretary of State James Baker is dallying with his meeting with people from the dissident Soviet republics. This obviously constitutes a blatant interference by the United States in the internal affairs of another country. It would be interesting to see how the United States would react if Soviet leaders began meeting with dissident American political activists and making the sorts of demands on us that we make on the Soviets. But an article which, or an op-ed column, which I think portends very badly for the future, appeared in the New York Times of Wednesday, March 13th of 1991. This is an op-ed column on foreign affairs by Leslie H. Gelb, G-E-L-B, the New York Times, I believe he's their military affairs specialist, but I may be wrong, maybe he's a diplomatic affairs specialist. It's called Bomblet in Moscow, and it reads in part as follows. Secretary of State Baker may have a bomblet to drop Friday in Moscow, his meeting with leaders from 12 Soviet republics, including Boris Yeltsin, Mikhail Gorbachev's blood rival. Mr. Baker also plans separate talks with leaders of the rebellious Baltic republics. These as yet unannounced contacts in the heart of Mother Russia are scheduled to occur only days before Sunday's nationwide referendum on the preservation of the Soviet Empire and in the face of mounting demands for Mr. Gorbachev's resignation. Skipping down, speaking of a huge rally that took place in Moscow demanding that Gorbachev step down, this happened a few days ago. Until last Sunday, the idea of revolution seemed remote to most administration experts. Then, with upwards of a half million Muscovites swamping the streets and calling for Mr. Gorbachev's resignation, the alarms went off. Soviet experts in the administration began thinking about the R-word, quote-unquote. The size and discipline of that rally gave off the scent of revolution, of Soviet reformers demonstrating street power, quote-unquote, and people power, quote-unquote, like their successful soul brothers in Eastern Europe. Reformers knew their chances of taking charge through elections and legislative means are very slim. They are not nearly as well organized nationwide as the Communist Party. The Moscow rally, however, may have convinced many opposition leaders that they can carry off a winning revolution. Their strategy could be to overwhelm the hardline forces by staging another mass demonstration in Moscow, letting it spontaneously overflow into government buildings, and hoping it will trigger uprisings in other republics. That prospect does not trouble some administration officials who believe, with the Soviet reformers, that Mr. Gorbachev has permanently sold out to the hardliners and that revolution may be the only way to eliminate them both. Well, it is doubtful that the KGB and the Soviet military are going to stand for that, but it's worth noting, and again, I suspect that that will provoke a hardline regime and a return to the Cold War. I suspect that that is one of the options that the United States seeks. There's more to that than just the United States. I will talk about that when I get into the archive series about how the United States lost the Second World War. But the return to a Cold War that would be precipitated by the reintroduction of Stalinist techniques in the Soviet Union is something which figures to result from this. Again, it's possible that the Soviets will simply sit by and let their country be dismembered, but I wouldn't bet on it. And this kind of dabbling by James Baker, meeting with the leaders of the rebellious Baltic republics, and we've taken a look at Landsbergis and Sejudis in the first installment of this broadcast, and meeting with Boris Yeltsin, directly connected to the Free Congress Foundation, this is something which figures to provoke the Soviets, and it's not something that I think we can view as a positive development. One of the things mentioned in this particular article, once again, the Free Congress Foundation goes east, is that Boris Yeltsin has had connections with Pomyat, what is described in this article as the leading Soviet fascist organization. And rereading this section again of the Ballant-Wolff article, it should also be noted that radical reformer, quote-unquote, Boris Yeltsin, has dallied with Pomyat, P-A-M-Y-A-T, the foremost Russian fascist group to emerge in the last several years. Pomyat's virulent anti-Semitism compares to the crude propaganda of the early German Nazi Party in the 1920s. A good description of Pomyat's activities is contained in an article which is the cover story of Newsweek magazine from May 7th of 1990. This article is called The Long Shadow, and it's subheaded, "The Collapse of Communism Has Allowed Old Hatreds to Resurface Throughout Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union." 5 decades after the Holocaust began, anti-Semitism is returning on the fringes of political life. The challenge is to keep it on the fringes. It's worth noting again that Yeltsin has apparently dallied, as they put it, with this group. And one wonders, too, about the extent of American intelligence involvement in the Soviet Union as well as in Eastern Europe. We've seen some of the explicitly fascist and Hitler-allied elements that are involved with the Free Congress Foundation, Paul Weyrich, etc. And it's worth noting now some of the things that are re-emerging in the Soviet Union. Talking about Pomyat and anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union, this article, once again, The Long Shadow, from Newsweek of May 7, 1990, this article reads in part as follows. In a dingy Moscow apartment, Alexander Sveshnikov, S-V-E-S-H-N-I-K-O-V, a member of Pomyat's National Orthodox Movement, sits in the gloom considering the dignity of Russia. A yellow and black banner emblazoned with the emblem of St. George covers his television set. May 5th, the date for the pogrom that has worried Jews for months, happens to be the feast day of St. George, a hero to Russian Christians. This alludes to an earlier rumor that there would be a huge pogrom in the Soviet Union. Pomyat people believe that the Jews killed Christ and Tsar Nicholas II. They say Jews organized the Bolshevik Revolution and masterminded Stalin's terror. They see glasnost and perestroika as a conspiracy to allow Jewish capitalists to regain control of the country. Quote, the liberation of mankind will start in Russia, unquote, predicts Alexander Kulikov, K-U-L-A-K-O-V, one of Sveshnikov's followers. Again quoting, it was prophesied that Russia would be the one to eliminate world evil, unquote. Pomyat has developed a sharp sense of paranoia and a fierce longing for revenge. Last winter, Igor Shafarovich, S-H-A-F-A-R-E-V-I-C-H, one of its theorists, published an article called Russophobia in the journal Nosh Sovremennik, Our Contemporary, that's Nash Sovremennik, translated Our Contemporary. Once again, last winter, Igor Shafarovich, one of its theorists, published an article called Russophobia in the journal Nosh Sovremennik. He complained that novelists depict Russians as ignorant fools who deserve and get all they have coming to them. The Leningrad branch of the Writers' Union split when 24 anti-Semitic writers demanded editorial control over a new magazine. The Central Union in Moscow divided over the issue of which Leningrad faction to support. In January, Pomyat operatives burst into Moscow's Central House of Writers yelling, "Kill the Yids," quote-unquote. The dispute gives an ugly turn to the long-standing battle between Slavophiles and Westernizers over the country's identity and destiny. Quote, in Russia, this is an old and noble question, unquote, says Andrei Voznensky, the poet. But it has been twisted to revolve around only one issue: are you pro or anti-Jew? Well, that last couple of, by the way, that last name is Voznensky. Once again, in Russia, this is an old and noble question, says Andrei Voznensky, the poet. But it has been twisted to revolve around only one issue: are you pro or anti-Jew? Matters of ego and ideology have split Pomyat into seven splinters. Igor Sychov, S-Y-C-H-O-V, who works in an office crammed with portraits of the Tsars and maps of old Moscow, says mildly that he is only trying to reinstill Russians with a love for their traditional culture. Quote, Americans are good patriots who stand up when they see their flag, unquote, he says, but here, people don't do that, unquote. Farther rightward, Dmitry Vasiliev's group wears black shirts, pants, and black jackboots. His name, by the way, is V-A-S-I-L-Y-E-V. Vasiliev gives interviews to Germans, but nobody else, in the Western press. Even farther on, the Smirnov Ostashvili faction practices a more comprehensive style of anti-Semitism. That name, Smirnov-Ostashvili. That last sentence again. Even farther on, the Smirnov Ostashvili faction practices a more comprehensive style of anti-Semitism. Smirnov's assistant, Ali Marabat, capital M-A-R-A-B-A-T, an alias, welcomes visitors to his apartment, dangling his one-year-old grandchild and saying, quote, isn't he lovely? He's a little anti-Semite, unquote. Smirnov believes that the United States has fallen under the control of Jewish capitalists, along with the media of the entire world. He opposes Jewish emigration, arguing that Jews should be kept and tried for their crimes, quote, unquote. Continuing with the article. Like all ultra-rightists in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, he blames Jews for the rise of communism and for its fall. Smirnov's argument runs like this: first Jewish Marxists brought about the Russian Revolution, then Jewish Bolsheviks such as Leon Trotsky, Yakov Sverdlov, Lev Kamenev, and Grigory Zinoviev led Stalin into purging the peasantry during collectivization and imposing his terror upon the entire country. Skipping down, Pamyat's true believers campaigned hard against liberal candidates in last winter's elections. They distributed handbills featuring Mother Russia caught in a Star of David, held aloft by a hairy man with a giant nose. They did poorly. Deputies sympathetic to their influence won only 10 seats in Moscow's 468-member city council. But they are playing for influence beyond their numbers. Pursuing allies among disgruntled soldiers and workers, they have cultivated the Soviet Army and the United Workers' Front, a right-wing labor group. Skipping down once again, to say that these signals have alarmed Soviet Jews would be an understatement. Quote, they are panicked, unquote, says one leader of the American Jewish community. The pressure has been building for 2 years. Every Jew could feel the difference, says Yuri Levy, L-E-V-Y, who left for Israel 6 months ago. Neighbors in my building, people I considered my friends, started referring to me in sentences that began, you Jews, quote-unquote. Nobody threatened me physically, nobody fired me from my job, but all of a sudden I became the Jew, quote-unquote. Levy left before conditions could get much worse. Jews in Baku, Kiev, Odessa, Leningrad, and Dushanbe are also frightened. That's D-U-S-H-A-N-B-E. There have been unsubstantiated rumors that some Pamyat factions require new members to submit the names and addresses of 4 Jews. If Gorbachev falls, the Soviet Union's frenzied ethnic minorities could plunge the country into a bloodbath. At such times, Jews become targets of opportunity. If the stories are true, Pamyat would know just where to find them. So far, Gorbachev seems to be playing a double game with Pamyat. Given the full extent of his economic and political problems, he would win moral points but no political advantage by helping the Jews. He has cultivated the far right while trying to reassure the West. Among other things, he has named to his 15-member presidential council the writer Valentin Rasputin and the labor organizer Vinyamin Yarin, 2 men who have openly dallied with anti-Semitism. Those men's last names, by the way, Rasputin is R-A-S-P-U-T-I-N, and Yarin is Y-A-R-I-N. Skipping down once again, that basically concludes this section of the article. We will talk about other goings-on in Eastern Europe later on. Well, again, anti-Semitism has long been present in first Russia and then the Soviet Union. However, this resurgence of anti-Semitism and this explicitly fascist and Nazi-style agenda is something that bears watching. As the Soviet Union disintegrates, the old process of scapegoating seems to be something that we should keep an eye out for. And one of the questions that I have, obviously I don't have an answer, but to what extent the resurgence of anti-Semitism and the activities of organizations like Pamyat, and we should bear in mind that although Gorbachev has played a double game with them, Yeltsin apparently has also hooked up with them, and we've seen Yeltsin hooked up with the Free Congress Foundation, Paul Weyrich, and some of the explicit fascist elements that he has incorporated into his organization, notably people like Laszlo Pastor, people connected to the OUN, etc. One wonders to what extent the activities of individuals of the Laszlo Pastor stripe is responsible for the kinds of things we're seeing vis-a-vis Pamyat. As I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. The last article that we're going to look at, the last element in tonight's installment of the destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe, concerns one of the most bizarre elements currently operating inside the Soviet Union. One of the things I mentioned last week is that having looked at the USSR and Eastern Europe through the eyes of the Galen Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that was brought in at the end of World War II, in which then became the department, CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, also later became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and then the former West German intelligence service, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, that is now the German intelligence service, because there's no more East and West Germany anymore, it is united. One of the things that's difficult to figure out is exactly what the Soviet Union is or what the Russians are. It's easier to say for an American what they aren't. They're not the world-gobbling monster we've been told. They seem, to a certain extent at least, to be naive, if you ask me, maybe even stupid. Either that or they're badly compromised. It's difficult to say past a point. But an article which bears witness to that appeared in the Los Angeles Times of Monday, March 4th of 1991. This article, by the way, also appears in the Sunday Punch section of today's Sunday Examiner and Chronicle, a somewhat edited down version of it. This article is by Elizabeth Shogren, or Shogren, of the L.A. Times, S-H-O-G-R-E-N. It's dateline Moscow, and it's headlined, Moonies in the USSR. Subheaded, The Reverend Moon and His Church Are Reaching Out to Disenchanted Young People. Some are seeking new meaning in their lives, others just want a chance to escape. And it reads in part as follows. Moon is making a big advance into the Soviet Union, where the moral and ethical structure of society is collapsing after being propped up for four generations by communist ideology. Soviet young people are tired of endless talk about reforms that do not improve their lifestyles or give them any security for the future. Disaffected with their own country and searching widely for meaning for their lives, they are susceptible to the message of Moon's missionaries. The last sentence again. Disaffected with their own country and searching widely for meaning for their lives, they are susceptible to the message of Moon's missionaries. Like many of the new Soviet converts, Komarov, K-O-M-A-R-O-V, who's a Soviet Moon affiliate, had been studying philosophy and religion on his own before he was introduced to the principle, quote-unquote, which suggests that Moon, a charismatic religious leader, ardent anti-communist, and business magnate, is the second Messiah. Skipping down. Since last summer, 1,400 students from the most elite universities and institutes in Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, and Tashkent have traveled to the United States as Moon's guests. A total of 1,600 more will go before the end of the year. About 800 are pursuing studies in Moon's theology, and hundreds more have participated in advanced seminars, according to Myra Stanecki, S-T-A-N-E-C-K-I, a San Francisco Bay Area native who works as a missionary in Moscow for CARP, C-A-R-P, Moon's College Ministry. The Soviet Union has rapidly become the new frontier for CARP, the Collegiate Association of the Research of the Principle, which claims members in 70 countries. Quote, The Soviet Union is now our main focus, that's for sure, unquote, Stanecki said. Moon's followers have offices in Leningrad and Moscow and plan to open offices in Kiev, the capital of the Ukraine, and Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan. During a meeting last April with Soviet President Mikhail S. Gorbachev, Moon declared his commitment to finance exchange programs for Soviet and foreign students and to invest in new industrial ventures to help the collapsing Soviet economy. Moon's movement has been given almost free rein, despite his long battle against communism. Skipping down in the article, Soviet universities have welcomed the missionaries and given them classrooms to teach about the movement, which has been criticized in many countries as a cult that allegedly brainwashes young people. Until now, only English speakers have been able to join the classes because none of the dozen or so missionaries who have been teaching in the Soviet Union speak Russian. But fledgling converts like Komarov want to change that. Again, skipping down. The Russian Ministry of Higher Education, Leningrad City Council, and Novosti, N-O-V-O-S-T-I, the President's Official Information Agency, are among the powerful organizations that have co-sponsored the trips abroad for students to study Moon's theology. Quote, Soviet organizations do it because they want to send young people abroad, not because they want to help Moon, unquote, said Igor Drobyshev, D-R-O-B-Y-S-H-E-V, a Novosti official who accompanied the students on one trip to America. Again quoting, Novosti thinks there's nothing about it that would be harmful to Soviet students. If someone offers a trip to a Soviet student, he will go. So what if it has a religious basis? Going abroad is the sweetest candy for a Soviet person. Well, again, one wonders just what the Soviets are. Are they stupid? Are they naive? Or are certain Soviet leaders and institutions, in fact, compromised by Western political and intelligence elements? Not a question I can answer definitively, although it is a fact that the U.S., through the Galen Organization and on its own, has been able to operate inside the Soviet Union for some time. One really wonders to what extent they may have co-opted certain elements of the Soviet leadership. Elements of the American far-right, notably those around Lyndon LaRouche, have long charged that the Soviets have co-opted elements of American political leadership. Those institutions like the LaRouche Organization engage in what is known as mirror imaging. They portray real scenarios, but turn around the political polarity 180 degrees, so that what America and Western nations are doing are portrayed as Soviet conspiracies. I wonder if perhaps there are large elements of the Soviet political leadership, aside from the ones that we know about, such as Boris Yeltsin with his Free Congress Foundation connections, that are in fact co-opted for and working for U.S. intelligence. With Gorbachev attempting to associate with people like Pamyat, and with the Soviets allowing organizations like the Unification Church to operate inside the Soviet Union, you really got to wonder what goes through their minds. In my opinion, we shouldn't allow the Unification Church to operate in this country. And last, most assuredly not least, we should bear in mind that as we looked at first in Radio Free America number 7, and then again when we recoup that material, recap that material as part of Radio Free America 14, dealing with the World Anti-Communist League, the Unification Church is very much involved with the World Anti-Communist League. The recent book Inside the League by John Lee and Scott Anderson talks about that. And it should be noted again that not only is Moon, quote, anti-communist, unquote, but that many of the elements of the Unification Church have their origins in the Korean period of history when Korea was a colony of imperial and fascist Japan, and many of the officials in Moon's organization began their careers in government service as functionaries either with the colonial government of fascist and imperial Japan or with the military of fascist and imperial Japan. And again, for the Radio Free America shows 7, dealing with cults, and number 14, dealing with the Unification Church as an element of the World Anti-Communist League, go into this organization in considerable depth. In the next week or two, we will be moving from the USSR and the destabilization of same. And again, you have to wonder not only what goes through the Soviets' minds, but beyond that, the effects of allowing people like Reverend Moon, also, although I'm not going to go into it here, certain Christian evangelists, people like Jimmy Swaggart and their ilk, have also been allowed to broadcast into the Soviet Union. It seems to me this can only be destabilizing of the Soviet Union. God knows it's been destabilizing enough to the United States. And again, going back to the overall scenario that I'm looking at, we are looking at internal manipulation of Soviet politics here, both with the Unification Church of Reverend Moon, and with the Free Congress Foundation and its allied elements. And one wonders how long the Soviet National Security Establishment is going to sit by and let explicitly fascist and anti-Soviet elements operate with impunity. I suspect, again, the scenario that we discussed with Lanny Sinkin, either provoking a Stalinist regime and a return to the Cold War, or the dismemberment of the Soviet Union, which has been the goal, by the way, of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, is what they're aiming at here. The anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations not only intended to roll back communism, quote-unquote, by driving it out of Eastern Europe, which has now happened, but they intended to actually break up the Soviet Union itself. We went into that both in Radio Free America shows 14 and 15. And again, I think that the destabilization of the USSR is likely to be very destructive because it is either going to provoke a new Cold War, which will be very destructive to this country as well as to the USSR, but it could also ultimately lead to a Third World War. One wonders just how long. Again, I can't see the Soviet Union just simply going belly up. Maybe it'll happen, but I wouldn't bet on it. It's within the realm of possibility that something could go wrong. As von Clausewitz, the Prussian military theoretician, said, in war one has to expect friction, and that is to say things go wrong, things go other than the way they have been intended. We can't say for sure, but if we continue to dally with Soviet internal politics this way and continue to inject fascist elements there, it is within the realm of possibility that it will produce a response that we have not foreseen. It is within the realm of possibility that we could see a Third World War at some point. As unappetizing as that prospect is, I wouldn't rule that out if something goes wrong with this destabilization policy at some point in the future.